Hello there, it's the Audio Drama Production Podcast. My name's Matthew, and just a quick intro this week before we dive into the interview. It's with David Barnes and John Wakefield, two gentlemen who were involved in the creation of Wooden Overcoats, which is a wonderfully funny and well-made audio drama sitcom. So if you've not heard that before, you really are in for a treat if you go and check it out. And this interview was great. We chatted about all things that went into making the show, so writing it, casting it, recording and producing it. So lots of great insights, and on top of that, the show itself really is excellent and well worth listening to. Just a couple of wee things to mention before we dive into that interview. I just wanted to say a big thanks to Ed Champion and EC Bond for their recent pledges to support this show on Patreon. Ed, I know, is currently working on a big, ambitious audio drama project. I don't know very much about it at the moment, but I'm sure he'll keep me posted with details about that as they arise. And also EC Bond, great guy, a great producer out in LA. He's made some of my favourite shows, including Supporters. That was an audio drama all about following the old football, or as the Americans like to call, soccer. So big thanks to those two gents and to our ongoing Patreon supporters. You keep us going, you keep us funded, and hopefully we keep you well stocked with podcast episodes and valuable content. And another wee heads up as well to Fred Greenhalgh, Fred at Final Round Productions of Lock and Key and The Cleansed fame, because Fred's just put out an ebook on how to record your audio drama out in the field, how to go out on location with your actors and record your drama in that manner. Fred, of course, is a bit of a master and authority of this. He worked on Lock and Key, and he has his own show as well, The Cleansed, which is into season 3 now, I believe, and it really is a wonderfully made audio drama in its own right. So if you're interested in field recording, or indeed audio drama production in general, check that out, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes at audiodramaproduction.com as well. Right, are we ready for the interview then? Let's go and hear from David Barnes and John Wakefield about Wooden Overcoats.
Wooden Overcoats is an eight-part sitcom about two competing funeral directors who are opposite a village square from each other. It's set primarily on the island of Piffling, which is a fictional Channel Island in the small village of Piffling Vale. And Rudyard Funn is this was the primary and the only funeral director on the island for nearly all of his life for Funn Funerals, which is not a particularly good funeral parlour, but since it's the only one they've got, it's the only one that they could actually get any business from. And funerals are likely to actually kill more people than the people they're actually putting into the ground. One day, Eric Chapman comes to the island and sets up Chapman's across the road, and everyone flocks to him. He's a social genius. Everybody loves him. He's wonderful at his job. He's wonderful of everything. And Rudyard starts to lose business, and the series follows Rudyard's attempts to try and claw some of that business back so he can sort of make a living. And whilst he's there, he's also assisted by his mortician's sister, Antigone, who spends much of the season deep in lust with Eric Chapman and trying to sort of get over this conflict within herself. And Georgie Crusoe, who's the assistant, who is seemingly capable of doing absolutely anything that the plot demands, which is incredibly helpful to us. And of course, we have many other sort of wonderful, varied characters. You've got the mayor, the reverend. We have this sweet shop owner / police constable. It's a really quite lovely series with some sort of story arcs going through, but lots of situations of the week, as it were.
It's such a brilliant show. Embarrassingly, I've only just discovered it in the last couple of weeks. It was when one of you guys stuck out the article about how you actually went about making it and started listening to the show. So I was immediately hooked. And what struck me is, because in audio drama, you'll usually find a show lacking in some department. Maybe, you know, it's very well written, but they've not got access to actors, or maybe they've not got the technical expertise. What struck me about this show, in fact, maybe I hate you for it, it's just good everywhere. You know, like, really good actors, really well made, really well written. You know, you've got direction and everything. So I suppose a really, really poor question to ask, but how are you also good at everything? Have you got a big team? Have you got lots of expertise in all these areas and backgrounds in all these departments?
Well, I think all of us pretty much are young and starting out when we come to this, in terms of the creative team that came together to do this. We came together because, you know, me and Andy loved David's script, and the guys, David, who wrote it, obviously, and Felix and Tom, who helped create the idea behind it. Felix, who plays Rudyard, and Tom, who plays Eric. They both knew us from work we'd done on student radio and work with our sort of... I studied at Goldsmiths doing a radio master's. And so they brought us on board. And we're currently sort of... I'm a producer for the Royal National Institute of the Blind, who do amazing work for getting audiobooks to blind people. So I had access to some fantastic actors and recording studios and things like that. And Andy had was working with quite a big production company at the time, and so had contacts within that that he could chat to. And I think it's the ethos that you should go into any project with, is know your limitations and know who's good at doing what they're good at doing, and turn around and ask people. But we had the sort of the gumption, the gall to go and ask some of the best people in the business to do it as a passion project. And that was the joy of it came from the fact that all these people just said, yeah, we love the project, we'd love to do that, and stepped in, and we had a wonderful time making it.
Yeah. I mean, from getting everyone involved, from what I understand, because I was just sort of locked away in a room to write scripts, and then they'd be sort of on my behalf, you had, you know, John and Andy and Felix and Tom were sort of sending them off to people to try and get people interested. And from what I understand, a lot of sort of actors came on board, and lots of other, it's not all that, but the writing team, because there are other four writers besides me, they all came on board because they said, oh, we really like the idea. And we really like this particular world. We like this script. And they certainly enjoyed what it was. And once they came into the recording studio, and you know, they saw how everyone was working and that everyone was really enthusiastic and they knew what they were doing. And, you know, especially, you know, beyond the fact that doing something on this scale, it's the first time you've done it, everyone had a good idea of saying, oh, we should be doing like this. If we're going to have to make it up as we go along, we will, but we'll try to do it as smoothly as we can. And we found that everyone we worked with just really threw themselves into that. I think they appreciated it. We had a lot of actors who've been in the business for quite a while who said this is one of the most enjoyable things we've done, which was a wonderful thing to hear and extremely encouraging to us.
There was a lovely thing. One of our lead cast, a wonderful man called Andy Seacombe, who plays Reverend Wavering in the series, who's, you know, he's an alumni of Star Wars and Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and all these, you know, really famous big shows. And you think, he came up to me after the show and said, you know, when you offered me the script, I thought, oh no, another person asking me to do something for free. But then I read it and it was bloody good. I'm like, can we do more? And I think that's the nicest thing anyone could say to us, because... The fact that we came at this with the intention of just going out and making something as a labour of love, just because we delighted in the medium and wanted to make something fab in the medium and introduce it to more people, that the people we should bring on board to do that became so in love with the project and the team that they're up for doing more.
Mm.
And that's the nicest thing that's probably happened as part of it.
So you've obviously built this big team of people with all this expertise, but if we pull it right back to the writing and the story idea, presumably at some point this story idea was you know, it was formulating in someone's head, and you say you've got four writers now. I'm just interested in how the idea developed, you know, from an embryonic idea to words on pages, and how you kind of went about writing it. Did you have the entire series, the first season, written before you went into production?
We certainly had all the scripts written before we went into the studio. The general timeline is that at some point in late 2014, Felix Trench, as we said, who plays Rudyard, had the general idea of two competing funeral directors. As that's what he had, is, you know, those words, and it's a fantastic notion. And he said them to Tom Crowley, who plays Eric, as we've said, and said, why don't we do something with it? And their initial idea was to do a short film, but they didn't know quite how to go about it. And then Felix came to me in late December and said, why don't I turn it into a audio sitcom, because we just worked on a different one. And over, you know, I sort of hashed out lots of ideas of how you'd plot a first episode, which sort of encouraged them to sort of pull people together. A lot of it just came down to, how is this going to really work as a full-length series? I very quickly decided that I think, you know, if you've got two competing funeral directors, you ought to make one of them not very good at their job, but still enough where they can get by and it's not ridiculous. And one's going to be fantastic. I really wanted to write something about rivalry, because it was just something, you know, everyone at some point in their lives has thought, oh God, there's somebody better than me at this thing, and I'm working with them, and that's awful, but they're also really great, and I don't know what to do about it, and it's such a wonderful inner conflict. I wanted to do something with that. But I think we sat down, me and Felix and Tom, and said, what other characters should there be, and how are we going to characterise them? We came up with the idea of Antigone and Georgie, people like the mayor and everything else. And we just, I think the best thing when it comes down to creating a series like this and coming up with the ideas is, always say, it's not necessarily just what's going to be funny, but what's going to generate stories. And we decided very early on as a production team, and when John Andy came on board as well, we said, it's more important to us to make sure we have 8 really good storylines. And I don't mind, from, you know, perspective as a head, I'm the head writer, I script edit all the episodes. I've written 4 of them. The other 4 are written by Tom Crowley, Christopher Hogg, Cordelia Lynn, and Tiff Woodsmith. When I came to them and said what I wanted, I said, don't worry too much about the jokes. What we want is a really good story that the audience will get behind. They want to get into the characters, they follow that, and if they really love the characters, the situations will be funny. And don't worry too much about it. We don't necessarily need it to be a gag-heavy sitcom. We just want it to be a really funny story-based one. And I think from that's given us the license to be able to throw in lots of interesting ideas, have all the fun, the characters that we've got. And there are lots of jokes, there are lots of gags, but we didn't set out to do that. That's something we thought, we can do that later. Let's really focus on story, make sure every plot is strongly plotted, structured, all the characters have good emotional arcs. And I think if you've got something like that, that's when actors can really throw themselves into it. That's when people like John and Andy can really sit down and go, right, we've got a really convincing written world. We can now throw lots of sound effects and backgrounds and really feel how it works. And I think a lot of that comes down to the central idea of the writing and the ethos.
I'm interested as well, what was the reason behind setting it on a Channel Island rather than mainland England?
That comes down to, I think, we did originally before, is this going to be a village, yes, somewhere in England? But when we wanted the idea of this being sort of a self-governing, sort of self-sustained world, there's also, if you've got a horrendous rival across the road from you, you can't just go, oh, move further down the road. You're stuck on an island. So it increases the sense, increases the sense of isolation. I think there's also an extent where, of course, there are lots of things that happen in the series which are quite ridiculous. You know, you have like a mayor who's in charge of a village which is nearly a town. Of course, that's impossible either way, but you can get away with it. If it's a small island out somewhere else, cut off from everywhere, then you have more free license to create wacky new rules.
They're outside the jurisdiction of reality.
They are, yeah, very much outside the jurisdiction of reality. And the way of a Channel Island specifically is because, you know, when we were looking into it before, where is it going to be set? Is it in the random middle of the Atlantic? Well, we want it to still be recognisably, there's obviously a lot about it which is English, but the idea of being the Channel Islands is because you're midway between two different very strong nationalities, but you've also got lots of other influences there. It's a real melting pot of cultures, and it's very, very strong. And I think that's just something we really wanted to play with. I mean, one thing that was very important to us was that we didn't say, right, they're villagers on an island, therefore they're sort of yokels or something like that. You know, these are very, very, you know, it's a very welcoming community. We want to get away from those stereotypes you see in lots of old comedies. We wanted something which is much more real, which is people on island communities are usually very welcoming, very happy, and it's all self-sustained. They've got a real strong identity and culture. We wanted to tap into that. So though the characters in the series are very silly, I don't think we've satirised anything because we didn't want to. It's just we happened to have created our own community of fun characters.
Which is very interesting people.
Yeah, and they're very interesting. Most of them also very kind and decent people. They just happen to be a bit peculiar. In fact, the only people who are at all unpleasant are Rudyard and Antigone, who are the lead characters. And they're only unpleasant because everyone else is so damn nice and they don't want to be.
I think the way I approached it when I was directing it on in that regard is I always felt that because they're on the island, they're like all the children in a playground at a school.
Mm, yes.
And they sort of know the outside world exists and they've heard words about being grown up. But none of them have ever really reached in. So, you know, they're playing with all the ideas of being an adult, having a job, playing cops and robbers, you know, running around the playground. But real life hasn't spoiled anything for them yet.
Yeah.
And the fact that there's this sort of almost joyous naivety in the characters, that someone should suggest going on a date and suddenly that the mayor goes, Ooh, that's a lovely idea. I'd never thought of that before, sort of thing. And the fact that Eric comes as this sort of almost sort of idea of adulthood, as well as the cool kid in the playground, is quite fun. And giving them that isolation to be able to draw those moments of humanity out of the characters is always fun.
Mm.
As well as the fact that just putting things on cliff tops sounds good.
Yes.
On radio.
It is. It's a big sound effects thing. You know, we have lighthouses and people running around cliffs and people, you know, it just gives a great deal more scope, I think, for the sound design. And one thing John and Andy said to me early on is, don't worry about economising, write whatever you want. And I wanted to have at least one situation per episode that you couldn't do on television or film. Well, if you did, you need a huge budget. Yeah, a huge budget, far beyond what we could actually do. And so, you know, you've got sort of fights on clifftops or, you know, things getting smashed up.
Or
and,
a mouse swimming in between bodies in a mortuary.
Yes.
That's the one.
Yeah, so, episode two. So Chris's episode, he very much went to town on, I want to create lots of interesting audio surroundings, flower markets and, you know, malfunctioning funeral machines. And formaldehyde fluid sloshing around and people swimming around. And a lot of this came down to John and Andy saying, right, whatever you can, because we really want to have a challenge here. And part of that is, setting it on an island so you can have a lot more sound effects. And even create your own weather. With our running joke that whenever Eric Chapman shows up, it's sunny. Whenever Rudyard shows up, it's raining. And sometimes the two switch almost seamlessly within a scene.
Can we publish the meteorological maps for Pickering at some point?
We'll work those out.
I did absolutely love the moment where he was visiting the press reporter, the news reporter, and he had the tape recorder at the busy office playing in the background, and he put the tape off and it was silent.
Yes.
It's just, you know, that having fun with the soundscape and kind of fooling the listener. I think it's really clever. I really, really appreciate stuff like that. Just before we move on to sort of the casting and production, in terms of the writing, and I love the way that you are writing these episodes. They're almost like self-contained stories because they've got, you know, they've got their wee arcs and their wee conflicts in each episode. How conscious are you? How much thought are you guys given to the sort of long-term story? I mean, Are you looking at this long-term arc where we'll see differences and things changing in the landscape and the characters, or are you looking to continue down the route of, you know, just having a lot of fun in each episode, or is it just about finding a balance there?
I think, as you say, I think it is a balance. Early on, when I... 'cause quite early, once I'd written a first episode and we all decided, yes, we want to do this, and I started to assemble a team of writers, and I met them all separately and said, what are your ideas? And we came together and chatted ideas as a large group. And a lot of the things that happened in the series when we listened to it came about purely by almost by chance, or by lots of people having different ideas and throwing them together. And then me and I saw various patterns and thought, oh, actually, if you put that story next to that story, that means that Antigone can suddenly do this, and Georgie can do that, and Rudyard can do this, and you have a lot of different story arcs suddenly arising. And ones which I certainly wanted to do on the outset, but I didn't know what they would be. So I'm very much open to the idea, when we, you know, if we try to do further work with this, of just throwing in ideas for individual stories, and people go, especially now, you know, they'll listen to a first season, and even if you were able and wanted to do more, they'd go, oh, I'd really like to do something with Georgie suddenly learning how to do this, or Rudyard doing this. I think it's important to have good individual solid stories, but to find the thread that goes between them. And then you find certain emotional moments that suddenly raise the stakes. I'm not going to spoil anything for any listener who's not listened to it all. But for instance, things reach a bit of an emotional hit in episode 6 of the series. And that's something which I hadn't predicted at the very beginning. But it's just as I was writing this particular episode, I thought, at this point in the season, we've had this, 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 and this. That's going to make Antigone and Rudyard even more upset or annoyed than they were going to be previously. And what we've done is we've also done added a few things, long-running story bits, which could easily funnel into the future. I'm not going to spoil anything, but the characters do end up in a different position at the end of the series to what they were at the beginning. And that was deliberately a way that if you finish the season there, or finish the series there, rather, you still have a very satisfactory series. But we can easily push this on to more stories. We've left the door open. And we've also left a few other mysteries unsolved. We've started plot arcs that can go to other areas. So I think that's it. As you say, it's the balance. Making sure there's enough for us to be going on with, should we be able to. But also make sure that it's not, you know, if that was the last thing you ever did, the listener wouldn't go, oh, I feel cheated because that wasn't answered, or we didn't manage to do that, you know. That's what we've been trying to do.
And also, I think it's important just to say how amazing David did a great job pulling the whole series together, in the sense that all the individual writers did write their, you know, their weird and wacky stories. But then David sat down with each episode and put in all the references to things like the cinema or a certain shop or, you know, all the things that come up in each episode. And by doing so, you know, completely gave this world a cohesive feel and gave this whole island a sense that the story was progressing through all these disparate characters, which lots of individual writers have put together. And I think that's a testament to how we pulled together the whole series.
How long did it take then to write between starting the project and finishing it for in terms of the writing of it?
In terms of writing, I think overall, when did we record? Was it June?
June.
And some of that was writing up sort of up to the wire. I mean, overall, I started writing, I think we started having discussions about what we were doing in December 2014. I started writing the first episode about 2 days into January of 2015. The whole series probably took between 5 and 6 months to write. A lot of that time is spent lying around trying to come up with the ideas and what you're going to do with them. For myself, I tend to be a writer who spends a long time planning something and then sits down and tries to dash the whole thing out in about 2 days whilst the momentum is there. But all of that is writing. I'd say 8 episodes to make sure that they were as crafted as they could be took 5 to 6 months. That's also allowing for John and Andy to be able to pitch in and give feedback as well, and do several sets of readings, because we did several readings of the cast to listen to it out loud and go, oh, that scene hasn't quite flowed as the way it should. And it's not a performance thing. It's definitely a writing thing. I'm going to take that scene back and rewrite it until it flows again. It's certainly not a case of writing a script and then immediately going into studio. Every script had about 3 or 4 drafts until we knew it was going to be ready to.
Which is amazing because, you know, most Radio 4 scripts would never get that. We had some wonderful people at our launch who work on some of those scripts.
Mm.
And we're just saying how fantastic it was that we'd had the time to do that, because certain scripts get turned around in a week that go out on Radio 4.
And I think that's one of the things about, because the larger institutions do have very, very set times and they have to do things. And so it is, you know, is quite rushed. And, you know, they do tremendous work, but under strong constraints. And whilst we had constraints in terms of our budget, We did have the luxury of having much more time to develop these things, which, and I know from all sort of forms of media and radio and television and film, the thing that everyone is always saying what we need more of is not necessarily money, but we need time. We need more time to do this. And because we're doing this as a podcast and as an independent production company, we had whatever time we really wanted.
Yeah.
So we could spend 6 months writing 8 episodes of a sitcom. And that's certainly the time frame I'd want to continue for, you know, we wrote more, was make sure we have enough time set by. That also gives time in the middle of 6 months to, you know, go away for a week and not think about the series for a while. Because, you know, if you just, I know for myself, I almost went mad at one point trying to fit eight episodes of plots and all these characters and their arcs in my head at once. I felt I had an entire island in my head. And I thought, oh, I need just to spend a week just lying down and not doing anything and watch television for a bit or just, you know, meditate. But I think, yeah, that's it. For anyone else who wants to write something of this nature, really allow yourself a lot of time to do it, to plan it in advance, to have readings of actors and ask their opinions as well, because, you know, they're the ones who are going to have to read the bloody thing. You know, I always like to make sure the actors are happy with everything they're going to do and pitching ideas around and incorporating them.
And, yeah, that continued up until the recording process when... while the scripts mainly stood as they were because, you know, we knew we'd honed them, we knew we'd worked on them, we knew we got the pacing pretty much as we wanted it. Certain actors chipped in and said, oh, I'd love this.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Steve Hodson, who's a marvellous actor who played the mayor in the series, created a catchphrase for himself from one line. And slipped that in whenever he possibly could.
Yes, but I think it happened once in the actual script and then... Suddenly in the studio, you found him, every so often the mayor in the series would go, exactly! Typically when he said something and been immediately contradicted and then just ploughs ahead as if he was aware of that, it didn't matter. He just goes, exactly, of course. And that's something that, yes, Steve did. It's the first time I've ever heard of an actor coming up with their own catchphrase in the studio, you know, after everything's already been scripted. And it was wonderful.
It is wonderful.
And I think that's it. Though I like to try and plan things as much in advance to make sure everything's very tightly plotted, structured, everything, you can never entirely cut out the spontaneity of the actors and directors actually in studio, because you come up with some wonderful things just off the cuff suddenly. And, you know, you don't incorporate everything, but you just sit there and go, No, that is really funny. Yes, that's very funny. Please, let's keep that. It's a wonderful idea.
And then there are other things when you suddenly read them out loud in studio, even that have survived the read-through.
Yes.
And you suddenly go, oh, that's not quite the right word.
Yes.
Or what was it? We had Sandy Topping was a character. And everyone turned around and said, that's Sandy Toksvig, isn't it? Everyone's just going to be sitting there thinking...
Did they say Sandy Toksvig?
Toksvig.
And we're not satirising Sandy Toksvig. She's wonderful. So we changed a few names because they sounded too close to real people that we didn't want to...
That we just subconsciously slipped into these things.
Yeah, so we, you know, I think, yeah, from the writing perspective, you know, wrapping up on that, it is a lot of planning in advance, a lot of sitting down, working out, you know, if you spent 2 weeks per episode, about 10 days of that is planning and plotting. And 4 days is actually getting the words on the page. A lot of chat back and forth between the writers and myself as script editor, bringing Andy and John, the directors, to have their say, having readings, getting the actors' opinions, rewriting, making sure it's all there. But then once you're in the studio, still being free to go, you know what, this scene doesn't work. Let's throw in some new lines right here and now. But that's the only, you can only do that if you've got a really good team of people all on the same page, all dedicated to making it the best thing it can be, encouraging and supporting each other, which is what happened with this. It's the most supportive production team I've ever worked with.
Well, that brings us nicely onto the subject of casting. So, when you cast these actors, were there any open auditions at all, or were they all people that were handpicked through your own network of contacts?
They were all handpicked. We didn't hold. Basically, we didn't hold any auditions at all. There are some slight variances there, but generally, we looked at a character, and at our first meeting, we sat down and went, "Who is our dream person to play that character?" We basically dreamt sky high.
Yeah,
and went, "There is no harm in asking anyone because we're really proud of the script." And just seeing what they say. And so we got in contact with people like Andy Hamilton, who turned around and went, yeah, I'm free, I'll do that. Paul Putner, who's the newspaper editor, who's, you know, a stalwart of the comedy scene, alongside people like Stuart Lee and Richard Herring, even people like Andy Secombe, all these phenomenal older actors who, you know, have real pedigree, just turned around and said yes. So we knew who we wanted for them. And then also we've grown up with an awful lot of people at university, in certain acting circles that we work in. And we've always been thrilled to work with those people. So we also wanted, because, you know, we very much like working in the community we work in, bringing those people in and introducing a lot of new talent to the older talent, and putting those people together. And I think actually we had an extraordinary cast, in the sense that we had some of the most respected comedy writers and actors of one generation meeting with a load of people from our generation who are really now just beginning to get huge credit for what they're doing. People like Kieran Hodgson, who's just been nominated for the Foster's Comedy Award. Freya Parker, who was nominated last year as Lazy Susan.
Max Olesker, who's doing everything.
Who's already won the Perrier, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's done loads.
And has had his own Radio 4 series. But, you know, all the... And Tom Tuck, of course.
Tom Tuck,
from Penny Dreadfuls. And all these people who are really making their way in the comedy scene now, and putting them with those huge establishment people was something, you know, even a Radio 4 producer often can't dream of doing on a budget that they're given. And so just to send emails off to these people and go, do you want to do this? Yeah, I'll give that a try.
Yeah.
Fab.
And then, of course, you've got your because you've got your sort of actors who've sort of been in the game for quite a while, and you've got sort of up-and-coming fresh comic talents also. You know, Phil Wang, Jason Forbes, Katrina Knox. It really is a huge list.
We're always going to forget people because there's just so many wonderful people.
Exactly, because, you know, and but then you've also got the actors in there, especially some of the central characters who are actors who are extremely talented, wonderful actors who just, you know, the wider public won't know of, who you know, who are sort of like us, really, you know, waiting for a big break to come along. So you've, especially you've got you know, Felix and Beth and Tom, crucially in those free leading roles, who
carry the whole show,
you know, they're probably not particularly known to a wider, or hopefully are now, but you know, who weren't known to a wider audience, who were just really great, fantastic actors. And some of those, a lot of the roles, you know, those parts were written with them in mind, because that really helps to infuse the character of a lot. The actor suddenly brings a lot more to it and then transforms it to more than you could have possibly thought. And I think it's then a wonderful situation of, you know, basically untapped talent, you know, very, very strong talent meeting up with, yeah, all the sort of other, you know, younger sort of right up and rising sort of comics, and then establishment actors as well. And of course, the whole thing's narrated by Belinda Lang as well, who suddenly thought, we'd like to get, who would be good for this? And Andy said, well, I sort of know Belinda Lang. Should we ask her? And she said, yes, all right. And then we got to, you know, she said she had one night in her schedule that we could have her in the studio. And so we booked her in for that night, sat down. She did all of the Madeline links in a single night for all 8 episodes, and it was absolutely wonderful. And then it's just, it's so thrilling for us when you listen to an episode and you boot it up and the first thing you hear is Belinda Lang speaking. We had no idea we'd work with this person speaking. And then and then suddenly, you know, Felix will talk, or Beth, and then suddenly, you know, today Andy Houghton or Alison Skilbeck will say something.
But you asked about auditions as well. And the only case where I can say there were auditions is we had our first read-through of, well, no, it was our second big read-through, but our sort of second read-through of the show. And we got all these people together, and some of whom we got in just to do the read through. But we were very interested in finding out, obviously, whether they'd be good for the part. And the two people who really came out of that were Alison Skilbeck, who plays Agatha Doyle, the sweet shop owner, who's got the most marvellous voice and most wonderful person.
She has very twinkly eyes as well, hasn't she? She's just wonderful.
And the other person was Keira Baxendale, of TV fame for, what's it called, My Mad Fat Teenage Diary. And Harriet's Army, the BAFTA award-winning Harriet's Army. And she came in, and I have to say, it wasn't what I'd imagined the character to be in. I sat there for sort of half the read-through going, do I like this? Because it just wasn't anything like I'd imagined. And then when she sort of settled into the role, I think we all just sort of looked at each other and went, yeah, That's not the character we imagined. But it's in many ways so much better than we could have possibly imagined it was going to be. And to discover that in a character, you know, it's become one of my favourite characters, and I never thought...
Oh, I love George. Well, Georgie is a character who, yeah, when I was writing, it was one of the characters who I didn't have somebody quite in mind, as I didn't know what the voice was. And whereas something like, you know, Eric and Rudyard and Antigone had sort of actors in mind, so I always find that quite helpful. But Georgie was, I still didn't quite know what I was doing. But yeah, when once we had Kira of that wonderful voice, totally contrasting everyone else's. Mm. I must admit, as soon as she started, I sort of sat for, oh, I love this. And I really wanted to see that develop over the few days we did readings. I just loved it. And especially as it went on, it got even better. And I just thought it's such a wonderful character in and of itself, that voice, that I then went away and, you know, rewrote various bits throughout the scripts to accommodate. And it was just exactly what we want, exactly what we needed. Kira herself is absolutely mental as a person. Absolutely. Such energy.
It's a great person to have around in the studio.
She's fantastic fun. And it just really sort of set off that central cast of Felix, Beth, Tom, Kira.
And also when we introduced Julia Deakin into that mix episode six, who is Georgie's grandmother, Nana Crusoe. And just to put those two together, this incredibly sort of acerbic northern sort of punches through that script.
Yeah.
Were just so unexpected and so great. And it's wonderful that happened in the script. So we didn't know everything going into it, and there was a lot more that came out of it than we expected.
So when you were in the studio with the actors, how much were you actually concentrating on doing Foley work?
So we actually did, we set up almost sort of miniature sets. So there was quite a bit of Foley that is live. There was a fun funeral set, which consisted of a number of soundboards with a couple of windows in it. Mm-hmm. And that studio space actually had a stone floor. So the actors clomping about the stone floor was real. We had a lovely old dial-up telephone, so the ring dial telephone.
Yeah.
And all the papers and things that they read in there, all that was supplied on the day. So almost everything you hear in fun funerals might as well have been on stage.
Yes.
Except for when we get into the mortuary and the machines and all that sort of stuff, which I think adds a vast amount to the experience, because you will never be able to replicate perfectly what an actor would have done with something as minor as opening a paper, or it's a nuance in a performance that you won't get again.
Yeah.
And it just adds that sense of reality and groundedness that you need when the characters are so absurd in their own way.
Because the actors were, I was only there sometimes, I was usually in the sort of the recording booth, but I know the actors were able to walk around, weren't they?
In
when you had like we're going to do a fun funeral scene, here we're going to use the fun funeral bit of the studio, and Felix and Beth and everyone were able to walk around. I think it was blocked in advance.
Yes, it was.
So we actually blocked it almost like a stage thing, but they were able to walk around, which is why I think when you listen to it, especially on very good headphones, you can hear people crossing the room and going back and forth and getting quieter and louder, to give you the real impression of we are in a space. It's not we're standing there with the scripts in our hand. They are walking around as if they were acting these things out.
And then there were some absolutely absurd pieces of Foley that were recorded live. My favourite being, for anyone who's listened to episode six, without giving anything away, this is right at the beginning of the episode, Captain Scott Sodbury, played by Tom Tuck, wants Rudyard and Eric to bury his seagulls for him in a big funeral off to decide the winner.
Yeah.
And we thought, and he does this through a sort of, there are no words when he slams down the seagull. He just says, sort of, gentlemen, choose your weapons or something like that.
Yeah.
And slams these two dead seagulls down on the table. And what on earth can we use to make the sound of a dead seagull? And I looked around my flat, and there was an old stuffed cuddly tortoise toy that one of my flatmates has. And we kindly asked permission, then soaked it in water, and then got our actor to slam it against a table a number of times.
Yes.
And it's one of the funniest things I've ever sat and watched in my life. watching a very bored man, because we made Tom do it a number of times, slamming a tortoise.
A soaked, cuddly toy tortoise
onto a table. And from what I hear from in the room itself, the studio, they just thought, what are they asking us to do? This sounds dreadful. But in the booth, we were sitting there listening to this, getting increasingly creeped out by how plausible this sounded. And our wonderful runner, Betty, who I believe is a vegetarian, was just sitting there getting increasingly sort of awkward and iffy about this noise. But it's things like that just came together on the day, and I'm so, so pleased they did. Mm. So yeah, there was a big element of that in the studio then. But then a lot of the Foley was then recorded later for each of the episodes. And me and Andy sat down, because we divided the episodes between us as to which we were going to sound design. Mm. And then we sort of co-produced each at the end to make sure everything sounded good. And so there were things like, in one of my episodes, was episode 2, where Antigone puts on a spacesuit.
Yes.
And
outdoor survival suit.
I turned it into a space suit.
Which suddenly turns into an astronaut, and it works tremendously well.
I always thought for that particular bit of kit, it might as well be a sort of... I thought somehow washed up on the shores of Piffling would be an old cosmonaut suit, rather than anything, you know, fancy. It's the sort of clung together and then scraped together a bit longer. And I thought, how on earth can I create this? And that ended up being some flowers going in and out of a vase with some footsteps.
I didn't know that.
The helmet being put on was just a bowl being put over a colander and fastened together.
I didn't know.
Then what else was there in that? There were quite a few things. Then the all the noises that the suit makes are all sort of... They're noises I made. I breathed into microphones.
Oh, really? All the gasping.
All the gasping and the machines ticking over. Is all noises that I made myself. And then reversed and put echoes on and played about with. The little hiss it makes is an air freshener going off.
Of course it is. That's amazing. And I genuinely didn't know any of this.
And, you know, things like that. And you just playing about with those and suddenly finding that the world was there.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, of course, I used the flowers for her to hide in the flower market.
Yeah.
And just seeing what anything makes the sound of is immense fun. But I'm very, very, very glad we didn't have to do that during the 4 days we were desperately rushing through the studio.
Yeah.
So I'm conscious of time. I don't want us to run on too much longer, and this is potentially a big rabbit hole. But looking to the future, you've admitted that you had to call a lot of favours here. You've not been able to pay people. You've had to look after them in different ways. Going into the future, well, to assure the future of the show, presumably you're looking at ways to kind of monetize and build a business model around it. Now, what are some of those things that you're considering?
Most of that at the moment, I think, because this was really just a let's see if we can make this and see what happens, and then we made it, and you know, we want to see if there be an audience. There is one. In terms of totally monetizing, I'm not totally sure. I know that for a second, if we were going to do a second season, we want to certainly raise money.
Yes, we certainly want to raise money, because this also came out of our own pockets.
Yes,
originally. And the way we didn't lose any money. In fact, we've made a little bit of money on the first series because we did live events in London where
live events. Yeah,
David fantastically adapted the shows for a live audience that went out almost as the shows were going out. In London. So, and they were paid gigs, and all the cast pretty much came back together to come and perform them again in front of that live audience.
Ticketed gigs,
they were ticketed. And they made most of our budget.
Yeah, we got most of the money back through the live show, so we went out of pocket. We'll be looking into sort of, I'm not sure how much we're able to say, because a lot of this is still very up in the air. It's still being worked out. So we don't want to sort of commit ourselves yet until we know precisely what we're doing and we can assure people what we're doing. But we are looking into various models of sort of fundraising, ongoing sort of, you know, sort of patron schemes. There are various models online already. I'm not necessarily wedded to podcasts, but are there for creative endeavours of a similar sort. And the idea, if possible, again, we can't say too much, but I think we would want to be raising a bit of money so we could perhaps give a little bit back to everyone involved, if possible.
Yeah.
We are looking into ways because, you know, the arts model is very much based on volunteering to a great extent, and people doing it for love, and we still want to do it for love.
And of course, the problem with podcasts is you are giving something away for free.
Yeah.
And people expect podcasts, I think quite rightly, because they're used to the quality that BBC gives them, do expect those things for free, and they wouldn't download it if it wasn't free.
Mm.
So in doing so, you are left with a very interesting prospect of something that's incredibly expensive to make, that you can make no money back, like you could on ticket sales at a theatre gig. So the one thing, though, as we were talking earlier, is that you do develop a community, and that community tends to be very strong, even, you know, no matter what that size is. And we have, at the moment, got a donate button on the website to help us make a second series. And that has already garnered
a little bit
of money without any real publicity.
Yeah.
And that's just so kind and so sweet of people that they want more and are willing to, you know, to say so. But all these things are up in the air.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, we are currently, we had a meeting very recently. We're having several meetings going forward. And once we've worked something out, then of course we will make a bit of a splash about it on the community there, so people know what we're doing and how we want to do it. So we're still formulating the plan, and it's very early days. But once we have come up with something, certainly people will know about it, and we'll be sort of reaching out to everybody saying, this is what we've made, we'd like to do more of this, can we get a bit of help, and we'll see where it can go from there.
And we've also, just to leave it on a nice note, we've got some fun little production plans to go alongside that. So I think you can never just say, please give us money and we'll make more.
Yeah.
I think offering people a little bit more and then going, you can have even more.
Yes.
If you help us.
Yeah.
So we can hopefully promise a little bit more of tidbits of wooden overcoats in the not too distant future.
Yeah, there's sort of little extra. We can't say what they are yet because we're still working on them. But sort of little sort of extra pieces of that sort of add to the world that we've created early. So we can do small little bits here and there in advance of hopefully a larger, longer season.
Guys, it's been a real pleasure to talk. I've really enjoyed it. Like I say, I really, really loved listening to the show as well. Just for anyone listening who's not yet heard the show, where can we find you online? And also, where should we keep looking for updates and things like that in the near future?
Well, we've got, the website is www.woodenovercoats.com. And there you'll find lots of information on the show. You'll find the episodes themselves, everything you'll need about it there. Also, if you go, of course, to iTunes and you search for, I think if you search for Wooden Overcoats, that you can subscribe to us. That's obviously one of the best ways. And if you subscribe to us on iTunes, say on your phone, you'll just download to your phone.
And when the next series dramatically appeared at some point.
If you can,
you
do one,
down at your phone one morning and there it will be.
Yeah, if you can do it at all, you know, that's where you'll find it. So iTunes is a big one, or any of your client sort of podcast clients, you know, wherever you use, you can download us from there. Also, you can find us on Facebook, of course, and Wooden Overcoats on Facebook, and we'll do announcements there. We also have Wooden Overcoats Twitter handle, which I believe is at Overcoats of Wooden. All of these will have the logo, the Wooden Overcoats logo. It's the blue logo with the two coffins and Wooden Overcoats, so it's all, you know, across the brand.
And I would utterly recommend everyone who's listening goes to the Facebook page and scrolls back down to when we were running the series, simply because there are some absolutely stunning illustrations that we have of elements of the series, of Madeline, of the moped, of all sorts of
seagulls,
of all sorts of things from the series that really just give a taste of the world that a fantastic artist did for us.
Yeah. And we can't say, because apparently, you know, it's dreadfully anonymous. It's a big secrecy because we like mystery. But we have, there are little bits and pieces here and there. So, yeah, it's mainly the website, or go to iTunes, Facebook, Twitter. And if and when we're able to sort of announce things or talk about this, and that's where you'll see it.